You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. President Obama touring New Jersey with Governor Chris Christie, who is kind of gearing up his 2016 primary. The Republican race in 2016 is going to be the Democratic race is going to be really interesting. Anyhow, here's what the president had to say.
7 months ago, I promised you that your country would have your back. I told you we would not quit until the job was done, and I meant it. Part of the reason I wanted to come back here was not just to send a message to New Jersey, but send a message to folks in Oklahoma. When we make a commitment that we've got your back, we mean it. And we're not going to finish until the work is done, because that's who we are. We help each other as Americans through the bad times, and we sure make the most of the good times.
Now, I've seen some comments even on progressive message boards saying, Oklahoma, both senators voted against Hurricane Sandy relief. So, yeah, screw them. You know, let's not send any money to Oklahoma. That seems to be rather mean-spirited. There's a lot of good people there, even if they have a couple of crazy senators. But it also raises the issue of at what point are disasters big enough that they can't be dealt with locally, that we do need, that we all, even if you're in California and the disasters in Oklahoma, that we all need to be in on this, that we all need to be part of fixing it, that we are our brother's keepers. Adrian Moore, Ph.D., is Vice President of Policy at the Reason Foundation, libertarian think tank, co-author of Mobility First, A New Vision for Transportation in a Globally Competitive 21st Century, the website, of course, reason.org. Adrian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be on.
I'm curious what the libertarian perspective on federal aid for disasters is.
Yeah, that's a good question, because, of course, libertarian is a pretty broad term, and I don't think there's any kind of unanimity among them on this. And so at one extreme, you'd have people that just, you know, don't see any government role especially any federal government role in these things. I think a much more reasonable position or question is, do we have the federal government doing, you know, sort of playing the right role in these things? It seems to me over the last 20 years, we've really shifted to where every disaster involves the federal government. So there's really no expectation anymore that for any kind of disaster that the state will sort of handle it on its own. And that's, when you consider states like Idaho, Utah, I can't remember either of those states ever having a disaster. I don't think the Dakotas have had a disaster in my life. And there's a lot of states that don't have hurricanes, don't have floods, don't have earthquakes. And there's states that have these things almost every year.
Mm-hmm. And but Utah and Idaho are relatively
to sort of self-insure a little more.
Yeah, but you're talking about maybe $5 a year out of your taxes going to support FEMA. This is a fairly low budget operation by the standards of a multi-trillion dollar, you know, federal government. And it really does. I mean, are we all in this together as Americans, or are we not?
I think we are. And I think that's why every time there's disaster, you see a huge surge in charitable giving to the Red Cross and lots of other organizations. Everybody feels like they need to step up and help out. And most people who do give a lot more than $5 a year. And so there's the question of how much more could we rely on things like that? How much more could states which do have disasters actually, rather than waiting or relying on the federal government to bail them out, step up themselves and maybe prioritize these things?
But you've got disasters that would wipe out state budgets.
Yeah, it's a small amount out of the federal budget, but we do this small amount out of the federal budget for 10,000 things.
Let's close all those military bases overseas, and let's go back to, you know, let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts. If wages had tracked productivity since Reagan the way that they did from George Washington until Reagan, the average annual income right now, the average worker's take-home pay would be $90,000 a year. Top 1% wouldn't have made out quite like bandits. They would have you know, they'd be 30 times the average worker like they were before Reagan.
Well, yeah, we used to be the manufacturer of the world, Palm, and then we
adopted free trade policies, right? Right, yeah. And this insane free trade has destroyed us.
We got outcompeted by other countries.
No, we didn't get outcompeted. We stopped protecting ourselves, and we also said to wealthy people, we're gonna screw the workers and give all the money to you. This is the essence of Reagan's tax cuts.
We didn't take the money away from the workers and give it to them.
Of course they did.
We did. Look, protectionism doesn't work. We did get out.
Protectionism is how we built this country, Adrian.
We stuck with things that required no skills. When
protectionism is how we built this country.
With no skills entering the workforce.
Protectionism is how we built this country. Adrian, every country in the world of any consequence that is doing well right now protects their domestic economy. Germany does it.
It was free. We were the freest trading country in the world. That's why we grew. So
over the last 30. No, that's not true. We had an average tariff from the time of the George Washington administration until the time of the Reagan administration of 30%. It went as high as 35, 36, 37% back in the 30s and 40s. It went as low as 29%, 28% at various times. But we were always within 5 points of a 30% import tariff. We were always protecting domestic industries. Alexander Hamilton, read his 11-point plan that he submitted to Congress in 1791 that was adopted in 1793. We were subsidizing new industries. We were, it was a comprehensive. We had an industrial policy in this country until Reagan started taking it apart. And then, you know, Bill Clinton put the nail in it with NAFTA, GAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, and
well, when we look at what a great job Congress does at managing anything, can you imagine giving them control of industrial policy?
Yeah, it worked really, really well for 200 years. It built the strongest middle class any country in the world had ever seen. It built the greatest industrial power.
I don't think it was the industrial policy did that. There was a lot of – I had seen zero economic growth studies that say it was our industrial policy that led to our growth. It was our investment in – it was our superior education.
Which we invested in, which you guys want to uninvest in.
Any other country in the world. It was free trade. We may have had tariffs, but relative to the rest of the world, we were a relatively free trade nation.
No, we had a balanced trade policy, and our tariffs. I mean, some of our tariffs were really, really, really steep. We have over 22,000 tariff categories, and if you go back and look at those tariff categories pre-1980, you see on some items we had tariffs of 70, 80, 90%. On other items, the tariff was, 2-3% or very, very low. We didn't have much of a tariff on carved imported sandalwood. We had very, very high tariffs on textiles, for example. That's why we still made socks and jeans in the United States.
Go back to what you were just saying about disaster relief. If the tariffs do one thing, raise prices for all the poor consumers.
No, not true. They raise wages for all the workers. We've seen wages collapse.
You think the owners of all those companies, the first thing they did with the extra money they made off of limited competition was give the money to the workers? No, the first thing they did was keep as much as they had. They only pay as much to workers as the competitive labor market requires them to pay.
Not true.
The workers are the last ones to get the money. I'm not saying they didn't get. There wasn't any benefits to them.
What happened was by having so-called international free trade, the so-called competitive labor market came to include the Chinese, the Taiwanese, the Malaysians, the Indonesians, the Mexicans. And, of course, you're going to see wages collapse. That's the disaster.
How are cheap products bad for Americans? How are low prices bad for Americans?
Well, when they're accompanied by lower wages, I think it's self-evident how it's bad for Americans. Adrian Moore, you can read all about it at Reason.org. Thanks for being with us, Adrian.
All right, thanks a lot.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, free trade, no disaster relief. It's starting to form a picture. Apparently, slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here, helping you win the water cooler wars. President Obama, by the way, this, I think, is a really smart political move. And it looks like he's going to do it. Let me give you some background. The headline is from the New York Times: Obama plans three nominations for key court. Let me explain to you what's going on here. Any federal agency, all the federal agencies operate out of Washington, D.C. And so the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Labor, the Consumer Protection Safety Bureau, you name it. Right? They're all, the federal agencies all have their official headquarters here in Washington, D.C. And so if you don't like what they're doing and you want to sue them or stop them or get a law or a rule overturned, as Marbury versus Madison gave the court the authority to do, you can sue them in the D.C. District Court. There are 9 district circuit courts of appeal, whatever they call them, around the country. And there's this D.C. District, this kind of anachronistic thing. And if you're going to, you wanted to say something? 11. There's 11 circuits. Thank you. Yeah. Which includes D.C. No. Okay. 11 plus D.C. So 12 altogether. Thank you, Shano. Shano knows these things better than me. And so anyhow, you've got these courts and these federal appeals courts. But if you want to stop the EPA from stopping you from fracking or something like that, you sue them in the D.C. court. No matter where you are in the country, you have the authority to use your local district court, or you can sue them in the D.C. court. So the D.C. court has 11 seats on it, and there were 4 vacancies. There were 7 people on the court. Now there's 8. Sri Srinivasan, close enough, just got unanimously confirmed to the court. So now it's 4 Democratic appointees and 4 Republican appointees, but it used to be 4 Republican appointees and 3 Democratic appointees. And so what's been going on? The game Republicans have been playing for the last couple of years, that there have been this, that there's been this 7, you know, 4 vote majority, 7, you know, these 4 empty seats as well on the district court, is they keep bringing these lawsuits before the district court saying, oh, Obama shouldn't have the power to appoint that, you know, to recess appoint that Labor Department guy, or the Labor Department shouldn't have the authority to oversee this particular area, or the Environmental Protection Agency shouldn't have the power to say that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, or whatever. You know, there's been a whole series of these things, and those aren't necessarily the right examples or the best examples, but you get what I'm talking about here. Anybody who wants to dispute federal regulation, they bring it to the D.C. court. And the D.C. court is the most partisan, the most politically charged of all the district courts, because it deals with all these federal agencies. And presidents put their people on that court. It's also the most powerful court and the most charged court for that reason. And, I mean, 4 members of the current U.S. Supreme Court are graduates, shall we say, of the D.C. Circuit Court. So people step out of the, you know, so, I mean, this is the first place presidents go when they've got an opening on the Supreme Court is, okay, who's in the D.C. Circuit Court who might be good? Because that person's already made it through the process of confirmation. That person already lives in Washington, D.C., probably knows a lot of members of Congress, or at least, you know, knows how the system works. They know their way around. They're, you know, it's typically a safer appointment. Because it's hard enough to get on the D.C. court in the first place. But the Republicans, because they have had this majority on this court, have been using that majority to knock down rules and regulations to harass, basically, the Obama administration for 5 years now. And you know, highly politicizing this court. And Obama had, there was another person who was appointed to the court, that he appointed to the court like a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, who sat in limbo for over a year and a half, and just about 3 or 4 months ago withdrew his nomination, or her nomination. It was a woman, wasn't it? I don't recall now. It's like, this is how, you know, how little this is covered. And what the Republicans do, the way that they prevent anybody from getting appointed to this court, is by filibustering the nomination, by saying you got to have 40 votes, or you got to have 60 votes, rather. We'll block you with our 40. And it's been an end run around small d democracy. It's been an end run around the administration, around the executive branch. So Obama now comes out and he says, you know, I'm going to put forward three nominations for the D.C. court. I'm going to fill that thing up. We just got one guy on now. Now it's 4-4. I want to put three more on. So it'll be, what, 7-4? Yeah. Seven Democrats on the D.C. circuit. And then they'll start deciding things his way. And the Republicans are already saying, oh, no, you don't. And Obama's going to toss these three nominees before the Senate. And if Mitch McConnell says, we're going to filibuster these guys, or these men and women, then Harry Reid is confronted with a really interesting dilemma. He either pulls the nuclear option, which is basically what Obama's forcing him to do, or he just totally wimps out, rolls over. Mitch McConnell, you know, laughs his way all the way to the bank and possibly to re-election in Kentucky. That race, by the way, is getting interesting. McConnell's in a dead heat with somebody who isn't even a nominee yet on the Democratic side. But this is the president forcing Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid's hand, basically. He's going to put all three forward. Here you go. Do it. Damn it. Do it. I think this is brilliant. And I'm telling you, keep your eye on this, because this is going to be probably the most interesting and most meaningful political action of this year so far.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And most people, because they don't know what the D.C. Circuit does, don't understand how incredibly important this is. You now do. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Speaking of which, states without disaster declarations, really? Major disaster declarations. This is, I believe, for 2012? 2003 to today. Okay, great. Thank you very kindly. Alabama, 57. Alaska, 38. Arizona, 23. Arkansas, 54. California. What about Utah, though? I thought there weren't any. Utah? Total of 31. 11 major declarations, 3 emergency declarations, and 17 fire declarations, total of 31. Vermont, 37. What was the other state our guest said? Wyoming? Wyoming has had 26. Oh, Idaho, that's right, Idaho. Idaho has had 33 federal emergency declarations. Illinois, 59. Kentucky, 66. Don't tell Rand Paul, he'll get very upset. Michigan, 33. Oh, here's a country that's only had one, the Navajo Nation. Or a state. In the eastern band of Cherokee Indians has only had one. American Samoa has had 11. Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, this is where Tom DeLay likes to go to watch slave labor and prostitution, 14. Wow, 19 in the District of Columbia. These are FEMA declarations. What state has the most? It looks like the state with the most is Oklahoma with 169. It is, California had 211. Texas, whoa-hoo! Texas wins the jackpot, 333. Rick Perry got the most. And then Washington State has 112. I'm guessing most of these are fire. Yeah, Washington State, 62 of those 112 are fire declarations. Texas, 234 of the 333 are fire declarations. Okay, so there's that. And then I was telling you about the D.C. District Court. Chuck Grassley has a solution for this. Right now there's a 4-3 Republican majority, four empty seats, but the Republicans controlled the District Court. The D.C. District Court, which decides all federal matters, basically. And so Chuck Grassley said, well, let's just do away with the 4 empty seats. So the president can't appoint anybody. There's no chance of Democrats taking it back until one of the Republicans dies. And maybe by then we'll have a Republican president. Chuck Grassley's proposal, as you can imagine, did not go anywhere. So, Don in Seattle. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, just regarding that last issue you were talking about just moments before, if I'm not mistaken, the president has presidential powers that were basically given to him by the previous Republican president, Bush, to order executive orders to, for example, possibly force the Republicans to end all this filibustering and causing the gridlock.
No, he can't. No, he can't. He can't.
He can't do that?
No. The presidential powers are really rather circumscribed. His ability to issue an executive order, first of all, he can't issue any executive orders that require spending money. So he can tell an agency by executive order, the EPA, for example, which has authority over both mercury in the water and arsenic in the water. He can say spend a little more time on mercury and a little less time on arsenic. But he can't say just spend more time on mercury because, you know, if it requires any spending, Congress has to do it, number one. And number two, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, or Article 1, explicitly says that the Congress shall operate, both the House and Senate, by the rules that they themselves establish. They establish and vote on those rules as the first order of business every 2 years when a new Congress is sworn in. And the executive branch has no say whatsoever in how Congress is run. This is the so-called separation of powers. Pardon?
It makes the presidency kind of powerless, it seems, in a way.
Well, to a large extent. I mean, he has the veto power. He can stop legislation, yeah. Although they can override his veto with a two-thirds majority, as Congress did with the Taft-Hartley Act twice, three times altogether. Harry Truman vetoed it, and they overrode him every single time back in 1947. But so he has veto power, and he's got the power of the pulpit, the bully pulpit. And as commander-in-chief of the military, he can do a lot moving things around inside the military budget, although Congress has gotten really good at specifying, okay, we're appropriating $116 million, which can only be spent on this Air Force base in this congressman's district. You know, so and he can't change that. I mean, he might be able to say, okay, you can mow the grass less frequently and serve steaks instead of hamburger. I mean, you know, he can change around how the money gets spent inside that Air Force base, inside that congressman's district, maybe. But depending on how loose or how broad the legislation is written. So
maybe
makes sense.
The IRS should audit everybody.
Yeah, maybe. But did you want to talk about free trade?
Oh, yeah, just briefly. I think I'll just make it as quick as I can. So I'm in Washington State, and we have a really good state economy that's based on a lot of local regional trade. And I think if there's a way we can pull out of these larger global trade agreements and go to more local regional trades, that would really enhance our economy more.
I absolutely agree. Yeah. Very well said, Don. Thank you. There's two things we need to do to take us back to the point when productivity and wages were tracking each other. From the George Washington administration to the Ronald Reagan administration, as productivity went up, wages went up. And productivity has continued to rise since Reagan's administration, but wages have actually declined. If wages had gone up at the same rate that productivity has, right now the average working person, instead of making $26,000 a year, would be making $90,000 a year. And thus would be paying far more in taxes, including Social Security taxes, Social Security trust fund. Social Security would be in great shape. Medicare would be in great shape. There would be no budget deficit. Because people making $90,000 a year and less, 100% of their income is taxed for Social Security, and they basically don't have any big tax loopholes. And then you roll. So how do we cause productivity to track wages? Really simple. You do two things. Number one, you undo all these stupid trade rules. Starting with most favored trade nation, most favored nation status, which you can track back to Nixon, but really Reagan started using aggressively. And then it got codified into a more simplified form during the Clinton administration with NAFTA, GATT, the WTO. Just pull out of all that stuff. Just say, we're not going to do that anymore. Number one. And number two, roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Go back to saying, you can make a couple million bucks a year. No problem. But after you make $2 or $3 million a year, you're going to hit an income tax rate on your $4 million a year of 74%. And at that point, people like Stephen Jay Hemsley running United Healthcare, and you make it applicable to all income, all revenue that goes to you, whether it's a dividend or whether it's a paycheck, right? People like Stephen Hemsley, instead of taking $1 billion out of United Healthcare and thus out of your pocket if they happen to be your insurance company, Instead of one guy taking $1 billion and having houses all over the world and all this kind of stuff, instead of that, he would say, you know, I've made my $3 million. I'll just cap my salary at $3 million. I mean, the board would say that for that matter. You know, I mean, why pay 74% income tax? $3 million is a good income. You can live very, very comfortably on $3 million a year. And that's what CEOs used to do. Throughout most of the 20th century, until Reagan came along, CEOs only made 30 times what their average employee made. So if their average employee was making $50,000, well, actually back in the Reagan era, it would have been, say, $20,000 a year. Well, what's 30 times that? $600,000 a year. Yeah, $600,000 a year. That's a little, you know, which in today's dollars would be about $3 million. And they did that because, hey, after that, it starts getting taxed absurdly. And nobody said, you know, I'm not going to work because I got to pay 74% tax. Hey, no. Nobody ever said that. People were competing for those jobs. So roll back the Reagan tax cuts, roll back the Reagan trade policies, and you get America back. You get the middle class back. It's pretty straightforward stuff. Al in Middleburg, Florida. Hey, Al, what's up?
Oh, good afternoon, Thomas. Good speaking to you.
Thank you.
Tom, I've been thinking a lot about the way our economy has been running everything. We've had wars within our country, and we have wars without of our country. Now we appear to be having a war back in our country again. I think the Tea Party has helped destroy this country, and I don't think they really care. And, you know, a lot of my friends say I'm nuts, but if you want to believe it, go to one of their rallies. When you hear there's a rally somewhere around, and you don't have to talk, just walk around and listen.
Yeah.
Listen to the things that comes out of those people that go to these rallies. It is totally, totally unbelievable.
Well, anybody who says they hate government is saying that they hate what George Washington was willing to get three horses shot out from under him for. What you know, probably hundreds of thousands over the course of American history, and perhaps millions of Americans have fought and died for, which is the United States of America. And but you know, you've got this cranky bunch of billionaires headed up by the Koch brothers, by and large, who are feeding this libertarian meme of government is bad. You know, you get rid of government, and what's left? Big corporations and billionaires. And the big corporations and billionaires are taking over. And I don't disagree with you, Al. I think that the Tea Party, to the extent, at least those Tea Party factions that are funded by the billionaires, which is virtually all of them in some way, one way or another, if only through the PR apparatus and through the whole system, that the Tea Party is, I wouldn't say at war with America, but is antithetical to America. They're unpatriotic. They're anti-American. They want to destroy the New Deal. They want to destroy the Great Society. They want to destroy the United States of America. They want to turn us into a third world nation.
Get rid of all government except for the police and the army.
Yes, let's turn us into the People's Republic of Somalia. That worked really well, didn't it?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, you know, the simple proof, I mean, just look at how the red states are doing versus the blue states in terms of quality of life. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And David in Addison, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You want to debate free trade with me?
A little bit, actually. You keep talking about how, or at least you did earlier, about how America should back out of all of our free trade agreements and start leveraging heavy tariffs like we did pre-Reagan.
Yes.
It seems like you're operating under the assumption that we have all the bargaining power in the world economy. A very quick example of what would more than likely happen is, let's say we back out of free trade and we start leveraging heavy tariffs on China for all the goods we get from China for Walmart and computers and everything. And in response, China says, okay, we're cutting all rare earth metal exports to America, and we're leveraging a tariff on all exports of rare earth metal products made in China heading to America. Right. And they have a near monopoly on rare earth metals, which are used in everything.
Well, yes and no, David. Check your history. They have a near monopoly right now on the production of rare earth metals. But do you know where the largest rare earth metals mine in the world is right now? It's in California. It's in California. It's just not operating. And the reason it's not operating, when they closed it about 11 years ago, and they closed it because the Chinese are mining and refining rare earths and selling them so cheaply that the rare earth mine in California could not compete with them. But we have the, those resources here, and we just need to reactivate them. In fact, that mine in California, last year there was legislation before Congress to reactivate that mine and help the federal government subsidize it to operate at a loss because the – and this – I mean, there were some Republicans pushing this pretty seriously because they were looking at a time when we may actually be in a war with China. And right now we can't make a computer chip for a cruise missile without some of the rare earths coming from China, and they're looking at that going, wait a minute, we might, you know, China might be the military power that we fight next, and we can't make a missile without their parts? That's crazy. And so I would suggest to you, David, that not only would ending free trade and going back to a tariff-based trade system be wise, but we should in particular be subsidizing things like the rare earth mine in California, and there's others all across the country. I mean, rare earths are not all that rare. It's just that they get extracted in small quantities, and they're expensive to extract.
So then the option would be to go back to what we had back before China was producing all the rare earths, where your average PC was $2,000 or $3,000, and that's not accounting for inflation. So
no, I don't think that's the case at all. The PCs were $2,000 or $3,000 back then because they were very expensive to manufacture, not because of the rare earths were so expensive, but because we were just beginning the technology.
No, this is even in the mid '90s, computers were extremely expensive compared to what they are now. They were thousands of dollars for.
I'm not disputing that. What's his name's law? What is it that every 2 years technology, you know, or every 3 years, whatever it is. Bill Gates used to be fond of quoting it, that every certain numbers of years, technology doubles in its ability and drops in half in its price. Moore's Law, that's it. It was Moore's Law. Thank you, Shane.
Yeah, and we've actually just about exhausted Moore's Law right now.
No, Moore's Law never goes away. And it has nothing to do with our trade policies.
We're getting to atomic-scale computing. At that point, Moore's Law no longer applies in terms of reduction in complexity.
Why not?
What we'll have, because you can't get past the atomic scale for computer parts. Once your resistor is two atoms across, you can't make it any smaller.
Well, no, there are subatomic particles.
Which they don't function in the same way. They can't.
Exactly. So then we get into quantum computing, and then you know, Moore's Law might go on steroids. It might become logarithmic.
What Moore's Law applies to is an individual technology, not computing as a whole. So what they're saying is that the cost we'll have for the same processor over X number of years, not for computing as a whole. And I'm just talking about one industry. China has effectively the entire supply chain. And what you're saying is
we used to have that supply chain here in the United States. I guarantee you, David, there are entrepreneurs all over this country where if tomorrow morning, because we were to put back on the tariffs that Reagan started taking off, if we were to put back on the tariffs on everything from socks and jeans, you know, we no longer make jeans in the United States anymore. We invented them. You know, Levi's was an American brand. We stopped making them here 6 years ago. That was the last jeans manufactured, or at least the last Levi's. If all of a sudden that stuff coming into the United States was 30% more expensive, there are entrepreneurs who would be looking around going, or computers were $1,000 instead of $600. There are entrepreneurs who would look around and say, you know, I can figure out how to do that here. And you would see a rebirth of entrepreneurialism in the United States. You would see an explosion of entrepreneurialism in the United States. It would be the best thing that ever happened in this country. And that would take us back to wages tracking productivity, because there would be such a demand for labor in the United States that wages would start to rise. Along with it would come the tax collections. It would end our budget deficit. It would end any concern about Social Security or Medicare going broke. It would put Americans back to work. It would end the evisceration of the middle class, the hemorrhaging of the middle class in terms of cash. The only people who would be harmed by it are the top 1% who are making their money in international trade.
You're completely wrong.
I'm not. 200 years of American history proves me right.
We straight up cannot replace the Chinese supply chain. American history.
We absolutely can.
Technology was different.
No, we absolutely can.
There was a New York Times article at the end of last year called Why We Lost Out on iPhone Work. I believe the title is. You should look into it. We don't have the ability to expand and change capacity on demand the way the Chinese do, and we never
that's
will.
Because they have spent the last,
labor regulation.
That's because they've spent the last 30 years investing in infrastructure. When Reagan said, we're not going to build infrastructure anymore, the Chinese said, okay, cool, we will. And we'll eat your lunch.
No,
and they did, and they are.
You're wrong. It's because they have campuses where people go to manufacture, and they live there for 12 months. They can hire 3,000 people in 24 hours. We can't do that. We don't have.
We absolutely can do that. You just have to be willing to pay for it.
Yes, with human rights. If you want to do that, you have.
I'm not suggesting we become like China, David. I'm saying we have done this in the past. You know, when World War I broke out, we raised our tariffs and we became highly protectionist. When World War II broke out, in neither case were we as dependent on one other country as we are right now. And it's not just China. It's China, Japan, South Korea, and Germany. There's a bunch of them that we're highly dependent upon. But we can change that. They've all become independent of us. You know, Japan at one point was totally dependent upon us. We could do it. Thank you for the call, Dave. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, we looked it up during the break, and Jimmy Carter created the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, by executive order in the summer of 1979. Now, how did he do it? You said earlier, Tom, that with an executive order, a president cannot start spending money. He didn't start spending money. What he did was he took a piece out of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, and he took a piece out of, the Commerce Department, and then he he took a piece out of the emergency broadcast system, and he threw them all together and into this new agency. So he took money Congress had already appropriated for the purposes that Congress had already appropriated it to these different agencies. So you had all these different agencies doing, you know, working theoretically together on an emergency. He said, no, let's put it all under one agency and just deal with emergencies. But it was mostly came from the DOC, the Department of Commerce, and what used to be called HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And this was April 1st, 1979. Jimmy Carter, a Democrat.
What a surprise.
Okay, this just falls into the category of this is just too good not to share with you. Right. This is over on the Daily Kos, and it's in their daily kind of summary of weird stuff that we found on the Internet. And the headline is, everything about this story is so wrong. And it is so true. I'll just read it straight. It's just two sentences. Two paragraphs. Three sentences. A new novel, right, a novel, a fiction book, billed as, quote, an old-fashioned bodice-ripper romance, end quote, was inspired by the life of Tea Party champion and 2012 Republican presidential candidate Representative Michelle Bachmann, the book's publisher, has claimed. Fires of Siberia, written by Trey Sanger, centers around Danielle Powers, a presidential candidate, quote, full of firebrand pluck and red state sex appeal, end quote, according to the book's press release. It will be released Wednesday by tomorrow by Badlands Unlimited, a company founded in 2010 that publishes e-books, limited edition paper books, and artist works in digital and print forms, per the press release. A bodice ripper based on Michelle Bachmann? It just occurred to me, am I being a sexist pig when I say something like that? I don't think so, because it doesn't have – I'm not reacting to it like her appearance or anything like that. I'm reacting to it like her politics and her stand against anything sexual and birth control and sex ed. And, it's just, you know, Somehow she, you think Bodice Ripper romance, and you don't think Michelle Bachmann, I guess. Duke Cunningham is going to get out of prison. Maybe. He's up for parole. Oh, actually, he's in about a week's time. He's going to complete his 100-month sentence. He took $2.4 million in bribes. That's pretty grim. That's very grim, in fact. And, of course, so much for the liberal media. March against Monsanto. Folks showed up in 50-some-odd countries, 52 different countries, over 400 cities. Over 2 million people marched against one company. Now, if 2 million Tea Partiers had marched worldwide demanding more austerity, it would have been on the front page of the New York Times. It would have been the screaming headline in all of the television news networks. It would have been everywhere. So tell me, where did you see the screaming headline about these incredibly successful march against Monsanto on Saturday? You know, if the Koch brothers get, you know, 200 people showing up for a Tea Party event, it makes news. Heck, if you get five of them and they're carrying guns, it makes news. But 2 million people in 400 cities in 52 countries marching against one company. Really not even one company. I mean, it's called March Against Monsanto, but I would argue that it's not, maybe it is entirely against Monsanto. My sense of it was against the business practices that, and the whole, just the whole zeitgeist, the whole, the spirit of the time, the whole gestalt, I guess would be a better. In any case, the whole idea that genes can be patented, that life forms can be patented, that life forms can be modified in a test tube in a way that will then become part of our bodies because it's our food supply, that we can homogenize our food supplies. There's an amazing piece over at Common Dreams right now. The United Nations. Accelerating biodiversity loss, a fundamental threat to the survival of humankind. This is a UN report. The Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, IPBES, made the comments on the 7th Trondheim Conference in Norway on Monday. Quote, "The accelerating loss of biodiversity poses a fundamental threat to the survival of humankind," warned the head of the United Nations new biodiversity body. He said, "We must combat agri-food corporations, phenomenal economic and political power." The phenomenal economic and political power that these agribiz corporations have. Yeah, sounds like a plan. Now, on the other hand, libertarians would say to us, no, that's not the role of government. Let those corporations do whatever they damn well please. Right, Craig and Sterling Mass?
No, I don't think so.
So you want to regulate Monsanto? You're a libertarian, and you're in favor of regulation.
I wish I knew the whole thing, but I actually try to grow as much of my own stuff as I can because I don't like government. I don't like corporations running my food. But I think what I wanted to call about was I think you have the Tea Party mixed up with people like me who just think government. I'm not anti-government. I just think government should be held closer to home where it's a little bit more accountable.
Well, I'm all in favor of accountability in local government, but just a simple question. You said you don't like corporations running your food supply, and you don't want government regulating your food supply. There's going to be a vacuum into which somebody is going to step. I mean, either you're going to have monopolistic corporations taking over the food supply in the absence of government regulations that prevent monopolies from forming. When Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 1982, we saw we had hundreds, thousands of small granges and seed suppliers and agriculture companies and tens of hundreds of thousands of family farms. All that's gone now. You know, 70-80% of our food supply is now in the hands of four corporations. And
oh, I agree. So I live in one of those towns that had a lot of farms, and now we don't anymore.
Right, and we don't anymore because the government stopped regulating.
Well, I think it's because the government and the corporations are working together more than one.
Yes, the big corporations went to the government and said, please stop regulating so we can get bigger. And Ronald Reagan said, yes, I will do that if you'll give me campaign contributions. And so the big corporations started heavily supporting the Republicans, and the Republicans started heavily supporting the idea that there should not be any regulation on big corporations. Because when you're talking about something as big as the nation's food supply, you've got a choice. You can either have we the people defend your food, or you can deal with Monsanto.
Yeah, I listen to your show because you're kind of at the opposite X spectrum, and I respect your opinion and think you do it well. And I just think you are, the only point I'm trying to get across is I think you're lumping a lot of people like me into Tea Party as their anti-government. And that's
okay. Point taken, and you're right, Craig. I shouldn't generalize. Thank you very much for the call. We will be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Especially, I shouldn't be lumping in with people like Wayne, the Tea Party activists who are just basically shills, you know, the ones who are saying, oh, there's no such thing as global warming. No, I know, because Exxon pays me. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul in College Point, New York. You want to disagree with me about global warming? What is and thanks for listening to WWRL. What does that mean?
Well, it means that, was it Edgar Cayce, before he passed away in 1945, predicted that the Earth is going to change on its axis and cause weather change.
You mean the electromagnetic poles are going to change?
No, I mean the ball.
The entire planet is going to rotate 90 or 180 degrees?
Right. Well, it's going to, whatever it is. But anyway.
That would be very disruptive.
Excuse me. And the proof is that all the airports in America are changing their runway markings. They're changing it, like if it's marked 340, they're changing it to 321 or 3. They're changing the number. In other words, the runways are a compass heading to.
Right. What you're saying is the magnetic north is changing. And
No, I think it's the ball itself is moving on its axis, like Edgar Cayce predicted.
Yeah.
And the caveat to that is that we're going to get a weather change. Now, there's an island in Siberia where they found a frozen rhinoceros a number of years ago in the ice. And inside the rhinoceros' mouth, they found fresh flowers like the rhinoceros.
Yeah, same thing with woolly mammoths here in the United States. In North America.
But anyway, that's in an island in Siberia. So apparently at one time that island was in a tropical part of the earth. And then suddenly when the ball moved, the thing went north and became frozen.
I'm familiar with the theory, Paul, and my understanding of it is that it is the magnetic field of the earth that shifts, not the planet itself. But the North Pole becomes the South Pole becomes the North Pole. That shift is preceded by an enormous amount of wobble, and that over the last couple of decades we've been seeing more and more wobble of true magnetic north. That magnetic north has been moving around a little bit. That it's different than true physical north. And as a pilot myself, I mean, you calibrate for these things, you adjust for these things, and frankly, there's different parts of the country where magnetic north gets distorted by large amounts of metals, for example, in mountains and things like that. And there are magnetic anomalies that you have to adjust for. But whether that is presaging, you know, the article that I'd read years ago was that was a 10,000-year cycle of shifting magnetic poles, and that it's been 10,000 years since the last one, and that it might correspond with the beginning and end of ice ages and stuff. It could be. I mean, who knows? But, if that means, if therefore we shouldn't do something about the fact that we're putting, you know, billions of tons of carbon into the atmosphere every year, I would say no, we still need to be worried about global warming.
And also, the astronomers are claiming that the rest of the solar system, like Mars and Jupiter and these other planets, they're warming up too.
Yeah, the astronomers aren't claiming that. The quote scientists, end quote, who work for ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers, are claiming that, and they have to the best of my knowledge, no evidence. So, you know, Paul, don't believe everything you read, especially if you read it on the internet, and especially if it comes from, you know, one of these so-called think tanks that are funded by these oil barons. It just, you know, oh, gee, everything's going to be fine. The polls are going to shift. Is sort of a variation on was it Earl Butz? No. What was his name? The guy who was the Secretary of Agriculture in the, or of the Interior, rather, in the Reagan administration. And he said, you know, oh, we don't, you know, he was selling off Western lands for pennies on the dollar. James Watt, that's right. Thank you, Jim. And it was, James Watt said, you know, it doesn't matter because Jesus is going to return and make all things new. It's all a variation on that. It doesn't mean that we don't stop, that we shouldn't fix what's broken right now. Paul, thank you for the call. John in St. Louis, Missouri, you wanted to comment on Bob Dole's comments.
Yeah.
For the record, repeat for our listeners what Bob Dole had to say over the weekend.
Basically, Bob Dole was saying that the Republican Party should be closed for repaired.
Right, closed for repairs until the end of the year, and Reagan would no longer find a place in it.
Yeah, and the two former Republican senators from this state, Bond and Danforth, both fit into that category too. They see that the Republican Party really has changed and gone so far to right field, if you want to use a baseball terminology from St. Louis, that they've totally gone out of the park now because they seem to be embracing a more totalitarian view. I mean, you probably heard from many people saying, "Oh, the nanny state. We're against the nanny state," and several of your callers have referred to that. But the same people are also saying that they like China and the money that's being made in China and the way they do business. Well, that's a totalitarian country, just like big businesses are, which you've been talking about, are totalitarian. They rule from the top down. Mm-hmm. And that's what I find the irony and in this whole debate is that you have people that are embracing a totalitarian ideal when you have other people saying, no, wait a minute, we believe in unions and democracy and stuff, because that's what a union is. It's
right.
A microcosm of what our democracy is all about.
Unions are democracy in the workplace. Yeah, and I do find it extraordinarily odd that Republicans who have been historically the ones who are hysterical about totalitarianism and communism are calling the program and saying, oh, wait a minute, you can't put tariffs on Chinese goods or any other goods. Because we, you know, we need the stuff that they make when they're a totalitarian communist state. Although they are liberalizing considerably, still, I mean, it's not what Republicans say they like, or maybe it is what they like. Because as you correctly point out, you know, General Electric and Monsanto and ExxonMobil and every other corporation is basically a totalitarian organization. They are kingdoms with kings and princes and princesses and the worker bees, the serfs. John, thanks for the call. Well said. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, am I accurately characterizing libertarians when I say that they don't understand the concept of America? We're back to the place where despair is not an option. Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, you know, the New York Times had an interesting report on Sunday where they were talking about some of these groups at the IRS that were asking the IRS to say, Domini, you're all nonprofit now. And so you and I get to pay their property taxes. You and I get to pay for their police and fire department protections. You and I get to pay for their deductible lunches and, you know, whatever else. And they get to try to influence elections. Now, keep in mind, 501c4s by law have to be exclusively engaged in social welfare work And according to IRS regulations, in other words, the way that they enforce the law, they have to be primarily engaged in social welfare work. And here's what the New York Times said. When CVFC, presumably this is Conservative Veterans for California or something like that. Anyhow, it's a conservative veterans group in California. When CVFC applied for tax-exempt status with the IRS, its biggest expenditure that year was several thousand dollars in radio ads backing a Republican candidate for Congress. Oh, yeah, we're a social welfare organization. We buy ads for him. Right? For just this one particular Republican. Right. The Wetumpka Tea Party from Alabama sponsored training for a Get Out the Vote initiative dedicated to, quote, the defeat of President Barack Obama, end quote, while the IRS was considering their application. It's a Tea Party group. And the head of the Ohio Liberty Coalition. Isn't it amazing how these guys have co-opted the language of the founders of this country? People who actually understood what the commons meant, what the, you know, general welfare meant, what the common good meant. The Ohio Liberty Coalition, whose application languished with the IRS for more than 2 years, sent out emails to members about Mitt Romney campaign events and organized members to distribute Mr. Romney's presidential campaign literature. So the IRS said, you know, maybe these Liberty and Tea Party groups are not actually social welfare organizations, given that so many of them are spending all their money to support individual Republican candidates, which is something that the law doesn't let them do. But now everybody's huffing and puffing about this. Oh, this is terrible. I can't believe it. Tea Party groups picked on by the IRS. Right. And then anybody who's ever gotten an audit who happens to be Republican comes forward and goes, oh, yeah, and I got an audit, too. Must be because they were in the voting booth with me. You know, whatever. North Carolina wants to have a papers, please law, just like Arizona does. This is going to be entertaining. And California has an interesting new problem. California, if Jerry Brown got, you know, he couldn't get a tax increase passed through the legislature because these right-wing cranks have actually gotten supermajority requirements for tax increases on rich people written into the California Constitution by proposition, by ballot initiative. And so he put a ballot initiative on the last election to raise taxes. And the majority of the people voted for it. They voted to raise their own taxes. Actually, they voted to raise taxes mostly on rich people, but still, you know, majority of people voted to raise taxes. And California, I mean, you know, they were looking at like a $30 billion deficit when Reagan was governor, or Schwarzenegger was governor. It was a crisis. I mean, Arnold was in such a hurry to get out of there. I mean, forget about his illegitimate child down in the maid's quarters. It's interesting how Republicans, you know, who was the guy from South Carolina? Strom Thurmond, was it? Yeah. In any case. Arnold left, and there was this disaster. So Jerry Brown comes in, and he says, okay, I'm a good Democrat. I'm going to raise taxes on rich people. And now California has a $4 billion surplus. And so the fight right now, and it's a fight, is how to allocate that $4 billion. Do we pay down debt that the state has, pay it off early? Don't have to do that. Do we set it aside in a rainy day fund and use it for the next downturn, economic downturn? There is one coming. There always is. That would be wise. Right-wing crazies in Oregon, where I used to live, got a ballot initiative passed, so we have this so-called kicker. Every 2 years, Whatever money is left over in the state treasury has to be written. You know, they write checks and they have to distribute it to all the people. So I get a check for like $36. Now, you know, Phil Knight, who owns Nike, who's a billionaire who lived just down the road from me, I'm sure his check was bigger than $36. But anyway, all the money had to be passed back out, which meant that whenever we had an economic downturn, Oregon was like in deep doo-doo. So they're proposing doing that in California. The right-wingers want to do that in California, of course. And then there are progressives who are saying, well, hey, you know, we cut some of these progressive programs. Let's bring them back. And Jerry Brown is saying to everybody, hey, just hold on. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's just, you know, straighten stuff. I mean, Jerry Brown is a very fiscally conservative guy for a liberal. So this is going to be very interesting to watch. Patrick in Park City, Utah. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Hold on a second.
I beg your pardon?
Hey, man, I'm sorry about that. I was I had you on hold. I had speakerphone on hold while I was listening to the show and doing some other stuff. Great to connect with you. We connected a couple of weeks ago. My question is, given the scope of really everything that you've identified with this incredible plutocratic takeover, hostile takeover of the United States, it's almost a hijacking. Well, it's beyond a hijacking, but most of America is really in the dark on how the whole thing works and what the priorities are. Given the 2014 election scheme, how did the progressives get out and really go after these numbskull Tea Party Congress guys and the rest of them that think they have the momentum right now, but and tell the story of what's going on and what
they point out the very simple fact that the Tea Party and the Republican Party are working on behalf of, whether they're doing it intentionally or not. I think there's a lot of good-hearted, useful idiots in the Tea Party. You know, people who have been watching too much Fox News and or listening to too much right-wing talk radio, and they think they're doing the right thing. But basically, they're working in service to the 1%. And that meme that the Occupy movement so successfully brought forward, I mean, before Occupy came along, everybody was hysterical about the national debt, which is, you know, is the Republican meme. Oh, we got to cut the debt by cutting welfare and cutting Social Security and cutting, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And the Occupy movement shifted the focus to the 1% versus the 99%. The 1% has had a 275% increase in wages, 400-500% increase in wealth, you know, since Reagan came into office. The 99%, actually it's more like the 85%, but basically, you know, the bottom three-quarters of America, four-fifths of America, has seen their wealth go down dramatically. They've seen their incomes go down, and that's the frame that needs to be used. We need Robert Reich just released it with Move On, a new video in which he lays out, you know, if wages had gone up the same as productivity since 1980, since Reagan came into office, then the average worker right now would be making $90,000 a year. We would have no Social Security problem. We would have no Medicare problem. We would have no budget deficit because, you know, people making under $90,000 do pay their taxes, unlike people in Mitt Romney's category. And plus, you'd have a strong middle class. And if we just were to combine that with some rational trade policies, we'd have America back. You know, we'd have back the golden age of the American middle class of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s. And so I think that just the pointing out that difference between the 1% and the 99% is a great question, Patrick. And it's a question that I guarantee you Democratic strategists are debating right now. And I wish they would take this really simple explanation. And the people who have, like Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown and Elizabeth Warren and Peter DeFazio and Jan Schakowsky and Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva, and I mean, you know, Peter DeFazio, I think I mentioned, they're successful with this message. It works. Dave in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sirius. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I listen to you most days on the way home, and you know, I disagree with most things, but you absolutely make valid points from time to time. But I question, you're talking about the IRS profiling based on, you know, the name of the organization.
Right.
Help me a little bit. How's that different than just racial profiling? Just by looks, you know, a cop pulling somebody over versus the IRS seeing a name saying, yeah. Hey.
Well, here's a real simple difference. First of all, we have to remember that that they're looking at groups that had the word Tea Party in their name only lasted for a couple of weeks and has been blasted by the president. In fact, a criminal investigation has been opened. I'm not endorsing that necessarily, but number one. But number two, when you're born, you have no choice over the color of your skin. When you form a Tea Party group or any other corporation, for-profit or not-for-profit, you have complete choice over how you name it. So I'd say that there's absolutely no relationship, there's no comparison to be made whatsoever, Dave. Respectfully. Thank you for the call. Just apples and oranges. Apples and oranges. It is not discrimination. It is examination. And the IRS should examine every nonprofit group, liberal or conservative. And if it was liberals for political action, they definitely should be examined.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
On the other hand, if it was liberals to run food banks, that's probably a social welfare organization. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can get a crystal heart literally made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And how are you on this fine day?
I'm recovering from a thing, but I think I'm going to make it. A thing.
Oh, a thing. Okay.
Thing. Yes, I think I'm going to make it.
You want to leave it at that?
It's one of those.
Oh, those kind of things. I see.
Okay. One of those, yes.
All right. Well, good thing you're recovering.
Yes. We start off with some good news. So I'll start off there.
Okay.
Americans' confidence in the economy jumped in May to a five-year high, according to the Conference Board, which is a private research group that checks on these things. Apparently lifted by a better outlook for hiring and business conditions. It rose in May to 76.2, the second straight increase. That's up from 69 in April, and it's the highest since February 2008. So that is considered good. Of course, consumer spending accounts for about 70% of U.S. economic activity. Also today came out that Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index, which looks at home prices, said that home prices in March rose by 10.9% from a year earlier. And that's the largest such gain in nearly 7 years.
That's 10% a year is almost bubble territory.
It's a lot. And they track home prices in 20 U.S. cities. They showed that all 20 cities have posted year-over-year growth for the third straight month. They think it's a sign of how tight inventories and growing housing demand have led to a surge in home prices.
Well, and mortgages are so cheap right now. I mean, I remember one of the first houses Louise and I bought was back during the Carter administration. And you know, when Volcker had cranked up interest rates and we were paying like 13% interest, and then you can get them now for 3, 4.
Yes.
It's amazing. Pardon my interrupting
you. Qualify, of course.
Yes.
And that's still the tricky part, is qualifying for a mortgage, because you still have to have such incredible credit.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a challenge.
That's the caveat. Today, President Obama and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie toured the New Jersey shore and played a game. And President Obama didn't do too well. They played a touchdown fever, apparently, and lobbed a ball. President Obama was 0 for 5. Chris Christie lobbed one ball, scored, won a teddy bear, and gave it to the president.
Oh, isn't that sweet? So this means that Chris Christie is going to be officially even more hated by the hard right Tea Party base and more likely reelected as governor and possibly put forward as a standard bearer for the party for 2016.
Oh, he's a shoo-in for governor. That is a given, I think. For 2016, he's interesting. He really is, because if he can get over that primary hump, I think he has a very good chance. His difficulty is with the primary and with the base.
Right. And that's always the problem on particularly on the Republican side is you've got to please the crazies. And then after that, let's say the base. And then you've got to go out and tell everybody else, no, I didn't quite mean what I said. And I'm really not that hard right. And it's a tough one.
It's a tough one. It is. Federal regulators, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency in particular, are widening a probe into whether the nation's largest banks, including JP Morgan Chase, used flawed documents and incomplete records to collect on delinquent credit card debts, the Washington Post reports, and they say that's according to four people familiar with the investigation.
Hmm.
They've got allegations that J.P. Morgan Chase used error-filled documents in lawsuits against debtors. Basically, they're looking at the process several banks use to verify consumers' outstanding debt before taking legal action. Of course, this comes on the wave, on the heels of the shoddy foreclosures that hit after the housing market collapse when, you remember, homeowners defaulted on their loans and mortgage servicers were accused of falsifying records and robo-signing hundreds of documents.
Right. And they all paid a small fine and made all the charges go away. Is there any chance that this will lead to any banksters going to prison?
Banksters going to prison, probably not so much. Millions of dollars in fines, yes.
Yeah.
I think so.
We need some banksters to go to jail. It's just
too big to jail, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Reagan did it with the SNL. I mean, he prosecuted over 1,000 people. He sentenced, you know, several hundred to jail. You know, Keating, Charles Keating was the most famous of them. And that was because he was, you know, subsidizing John McCain. But it's like, you know, Reagan could do it. Why can't Obama do it? I don't get it.
It just doesn't seem to happen anymore.
Yeah, I guess not.
The Supreme Court today, in a victory for Planned Parenthood, said it wasn't going to hear a case about whether the state of Indiana could prevent Planned Parenthood from receiving federal Medicaid funding for any medical services it offers to low-income people. The supporters of this law in Indiana, which was blocked by an appeals court, wanted to prohibit any government funding for medical programs of Planned Parenthood, like cancer and HIV screenings, because Planned Parenthood also provides abortion services.
Right.
The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said the state law went too far, and the justices didn't comment today in rejecting the state's appeal of that ruling, just said, we're not hearing it, and that state ruling that the law went too far effectively stands.
So the net is Mike Pence loses and... No, wait a minute. Indiana. Who's there? Indiana.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's
the
Pence.
Indiana.
Yeah, Mike Pence. Yeah, Mike Pence loses and Planned Parenthood wins.
Correct.
Yeah, it was Mitch Daniels before. Anyhow.
Planned Parenthood wins, yes.
Yep.
Walmart has pleaded guilty to charges that the company dumped hazardous waste in California.
Oh, really? Is anybody from Walmart going to go to jail?
Oh, well.
No.
They are going to pay $81 million in a fine, which is also going to cover charges in Missouri, too.
Oh, gee. What a terrible thing. It's like, you know, well, I guess my commentary is self-evident. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And... it'll be interesting to see if anybody picks this up as an actual story. This from The Onion. Generally, Onion stories are, you know, they don't get picked up. There's that new site out Current, I think it is, yeah. Current or whatever. But members of Senator John McCain's family expressed deep concern Tuesday after receiving word that the aging legislator had wandered off into Syria. His wife, Cindy, McCain's wife, Cindy, said upon learning that her 76-year-old husband turned up in the war-torn country after ambling across the Turkey-Syria border and delivering a rambling, incoherent speech to a group of rebels, said, unfortunately, this has been happening a lot lately. He'll walk out of the Capitol building, get disoriented, and then we get a call late at night saying that John is in Syria. Then one of us has to go to Syria, pick him up, and bring him back to Washington. We're going to have to sit down soon and decide what to do about this before he seriously hurts himself. McCain's wife added that her husband's recent trip to Syria was the most alarming episode for the family since the elderly Arizona senior senator got in his car, started driving, and ended up lost in the 2008 presidential election. Yeah. Okay. We shouldn't do, you know, age jokes here as
I'm getting a little older every day, too.
Okay. What I wanted to talk to, actually, age jokes are perfect because I wanted to talk to you about phytonutrients. No, this isn't an infomercial. Phytonutrients like anthocyanins. These are the things that are associated with purple colors. Find lots of them in blueberries and blue corn and stuff like that. They're antioxidants. They're anti-cancer. Some of them help memory and help the brain. And there's just, you know, there's like good stuff in food, right? And so when you think about good foods, superfoods, what do you think about? You think about, oh, you know, hey, fresh corn on the cob or spinach. Not so much. There's a really interesting piece in the New York Times over the weekend about phytonutrients, nutrients that come from plants that are produced by photosynthesis and, you know, plant metabolism. And what they found is that when we were hunters and gatherers, now keep in mind the human race appeared is the wrong word, but the earliest evidence of modern humans mutated or whatever, roughly 165,000 years ago in Eastern Africa. When we first appeared, we appeared as hunter-gatherers, and some would say scavengers. And we were hunter-gatherers for 155,000 years. Most of human history. And just in the last 7,000 to 10,000 years have we been farmers, agriculturalists. And when we were hunter-gatherers, we would, you know, we knew what was edible and what wasn't. And we ate a wide variety of foods. I read about this in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I think that the average, I'm trying to remember the numbers. I wrote this book in 92. My recollection is that the average hunter-gatherer would eat several hundred different foods during the course of a year. And that the average American eats only dozens of foods during the course of a year, or even during the course of their lifetime. I mean, just think of all the foods that you eat, right? There's really not that many. What? Breads? Lettuce? Tomatoes? Onions? Pickles? Burgers? Fish? Whatever, you know, if you're a meat eater. Green peppers? I mean, it's just, you know, there's like, I mean, you start adding them up and it's like maybe 30. And that's all we eat. And it used to be that, you know, half the things out there that were growing, we would eat. I remember back in the 70s, Louise and I took a course at Wayne State University, back when she was pregnant with our eldest. She and I took this course at Wayne State. We were living down in Detroit at the time on wild edible plants. It was actually, wild plant taxonomy was the name of the course because you got to make it sound scientific. Taxonomy is the science of, you know, organizing things into categories. But basically what we did is we went out in the woods, you know, with the professor and the forests and the fields and we picked the rushes burst into cotton at the end of the year. They look like a hot dog when they're mature. We'd pick those when they were raw, and we'd get lilies, and we'd get the pigweed, and all these different plants. Dozens of different plants that we started adding to our diet, including dandelion greens. The key to dandelion greens is you have to get them when they're really, really young, when they're real small and real fresh, and then they're not just horribly bitter; they're only moderately bitter. Anyhow, we learn how to cook all these things, and we fiddlehead ferns when they're just before they uncoil. In fact, Louise and I had some fiddlehead ferns when we were in Vermont weekend before last. So what has happened is because we no longer eat this stuff, we're no longer getting nutrients, because what happened is over 10,000 years of agriculture, and in particular the last 100 years, and in particular the last 30 years of corporate agriculture, is that we have been planting, breeding for and planting things that are starchy and sweet or fatty and not things that have lots of nutrients. And so our diet basically doesn't have the nutrition in it that it used to. For example, corn. Blue corn has 99.5 milligrams of anthocyanins per 100 grams of dried corn. 99 milligrams in blue corn. But we don't eat blue corn. We eat white and yellow corn. White corn has 1 milligram. Yellow corn's a little better, 70 milligrams if it's really bright yellow. But the blue is the good stuff. Go into a store and say, hey, I'd like to get some blue corn on the cob. You know, the kind of stuff that the Hopis used to eat. Sorry, not so much. Spinach. We think spinach. Ah, Popeye, yeah. Eat my spinach. Well, there's 0.89 milligrams of antioxidants per 100 grams of spinach. That's 0.89. That's less than 1 milligram of antioxidants in 100 grams of spinach. Dandelion greens, on the other hand, have 6.89 milligrams of antioxidants per 100 grams. That's like 700% more. Apples, Granny Smith and Red Delicious apples, they have 205 and 108 milligrams of phytonutrients, respectively, per liter of juice. That sounds pretty good, 205 milligrams of phytonutrients in a liter. Check out crab apples. When I was a kid, we used to eat crab apples. I remember crab apples. Siberian crab apple, 4,600 milligrams of phytonutrients per liter of juice. Sikkim crab apples, 7,181 milligrams of phytonutrients. But that's only half the problem. Number one, our food no longer is nutritious. The other half of the problem is that we're no longer connected with nature that produces our food. BBC did a thing a while ago where they asked kids, where do potato chips come from? They call them potato crisps. Where do potato chips come from? And the kids didn't know. They didn't know where potatoes came from either. It's like we're not connected with nature. And because we're not connected with nature, we don't consider nature sacred. And because we don't consider nature sacred, we do things like create genetically modified organisms and trash the planet with our waste and with our pollution, and then we sit around and have debates about whether global warming is real or not. Because we've disconnected ourselves from nature. It's a sick culture, and now we're getting sick bodies.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think we need to go back to a little bit of hunter-gathering, and you can do that by growing a garden instead of a lawn. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Dave in Ellicott City, Maryland. Hey, Dave, you have the inside skinny on the magnetic pole flip theory?
Well, actually, how you doing, Tom? Thank you for everything you do, by the way.
Sure.
It's actually not the magnetic pole I think he's talking about flipping. There's another theory out there. It's a little bit wacky. where if you look at plate tectonics, and you know that what's driving plate tectonics is the convection cycle of the magma underneath the
right.
crust of the Earth. If you look at that as a second order effect and think of the skin of the Earth as a single unit, this theory postulates that the entire skin slips.
Whoa.
For what reason? I have no idea, because no one's ever been able to propose a mechanism for it. It's totally goofy. But this is the theory they're talking about.
Well, and the magma is sufficiently thick. The skin of the Earth is sort of like the skin of an apple. If the outer half inch of the white, you know, the meat of the apple were a little more viscous, say it were like caramel, you know.
Right.
But it's still like caramel. I mean, it's you can't just flip that thing. And beyond that. The evidence that they cite of finding like a woolly mammoth with, you know, butterflies or buttercups in its mouth. I mean, if the entire planet's skin were to slip, the it would be so violent Nothing would be, you know, nothing would remain standing. I mean, it would
Exactly. And like I said, there's no mechanism to suggest that that could ever happen. But that's what they're talking about, not a magnetic pole flip, which happens, by the way, every 400,000 to 800,000 years. It takes 10,000 years for the flip to happen.
Ah.
It happens on longer centers.
Okay.
But there was another geeky science thing I wanted to hit you on. A couple of weeks ago, you were talking about the seeds of inequity and how bad people feel when they're treated
unequally
by their employers.
Right.
There was an experiment done, and there's actually a YouTube of this. It's hilarious. It's if you just go to YouTube under Equal Pay for Monkeys, this guy put two monkeys in adjacent cages and assigned them each a task. The task was to hand him a stone. And when the monkey handed him a stone, he gave them a reward. One monkey he gave a cucumber, and one monkey he gave a grape. Now, they can see each other, and in monkey parlance, a cucumber is a much lesser reward than a grape. So the monkey getting the grape is getting a much better reward.
Uh-huh, because it's sweeter.
The first time he does it, the monkey's happy with the cucumber. The second time, after he sees the other one get a grape, he throws the cucumber back at the scientist.
Ha!
Okay? And, you know, he gets much more upset about it. Now, it's really funny to watch and all, but when you think about it, that's the seed of the feeling that people have. So on the one hand, it's funny because it's monkeys and they're cute and all. But on the other hand, this is primate behavior.
Yes, and we are primates.
We're part of that chain. Here's an interesting thing. Now, when they did the same experiment, and he talks about it, he doesn't show this, but when they did the same experiment with chimps, which is a higher order primate, the chimp that was getting the grape would see what was going on and would refuse to take the grape until the other chimp got a grape.
Wow, altruistic behavior.
Well, when I mentioned that to my wife, she laughed and said, "It sounds like a union."
Yeah, that is extraordinary. And you know, this
amazing.
This ties in perfectly with Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkerson's research in the spirit level, where they look at all of these social ills that come about as a result of a growing gap in inequality. You know, a growing gap between the rich and the poor. And one of the things that they found was most distressed by the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer and the middle class going away, was social trust. Literally the ability to trust other people in society and even in one's own family. And as social trust disintegrates, ultimately society disintegrates. It's funny. We do a lot of the put together work on this show, on this radio show over at the TV studio where I do a TV show in the evening. And they've got a wall where there's Fox and CNN and MSNBC and their network and all this other stuff, RT. And it's like I have noticed this because I'm seeing all three of these cable networks, you know, for 4 or 5 hours every day. They're just, you know, in the peripheral vision. And Fox is constantly doing stories about horrors, you know, how to protect yourself from this, you know, how to protect yourself from being beaten up at night or protect yourself from the rapists or the, you know, the bad guys are coming. And it's just like this kind of be afraid stuff. And it's the social unraveling.
Yeah, it's like, you know, remember Alan Greenspan saying that part of his job as Fed chairman was to maintain a level of anxiety to keep the middle class in line.
A certain minimal necessary level of economic insecurity was his phrase. Yes.
Yeah.
And so we would not have what he called wage inflation. In other words, so workers would not demand wage increases. I have that quote in my book, Screwed. Dave, you are going to get a copy of which book? Rebooting the American Dream.
Screwed, please.
Screwed?
Yes, please.
Okay.
I have Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. It's a wonderful read. But
do we have a copy?
I've been meaning to get that one.
Shane is pretty sure we're all out of Screwed. Cracking the Code, Rebooting the American Dream. What else?
Rebooting the Dream. That would be great.
Rebooting the American Dream. Okay, cool. Dave, I'm going to put you on hold. Thank you for the call. And that's great. I love it. He's on line four, Danielle. And so Danielle's going to pick you up and get your information. And we're going to have to contact our publisher and get another case of Screwed because that's such a great book. I love giving that away too. Mike in Schererville, Indiana. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Good. 501c4s?
I'm sorry?
You have a 501c4?
No, but Stephen Colbert does.
Oh, yeah. I don't know that he actually went through the whole IRS thing. I think he just filed with the FEC.
Well, he had another installment where he had his attorney on either last Monday or the Monday before.
Uh-huh. Okay.
according to his attorney for his super PAC and these 50 these organizations,
right.
They never had to file.
Right. Well, you would only file for nonprofit status if you want deductions, if you want donations to be deductible. You can create a super PAC as a for-profit corporation, and you don't have to file for nonprofit status. So,
let's say maybe they were setting a trap to bust the IRS on it.
No, I don't think so. I think that they were trying to show what a super PAC is, and it could be either way.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Although that said, I didn't watch the episode and I didn't hear the attorney, and so don't take my word for it. I'm clueless. You should ask Stephen Colbert. Bad and the very, very nudificously ugly, the good. Senator Dick Durbin. During an appearance on Fox News Sunday this weekend, the Illinois senator explained to host Chris Wallace and Fox so-called news viewers why the IRS should have paid more attention to groups like Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS 501c4.
Let's get back to the basics. Citizens United really unleashed hundreds, if not thousands, of organizations seeking tax-exempt status to play in political campaigns. The law we wrote, as Congress, said that they had to exclusively be engaged in social welfare and not politics and campaigning. And so here is the IRS trying to decide whether or not these organizations really comply with the law. Crossroads was Exhibit A. They were boastful about how much money they were going to raise and beat Democrats with.
Yeah, well said, Senator. The abuse of the tax code by Crossroads GPS and other groups like it is the real IRS scandal, and no one needs to hear that more than Fox News viewers. The bad. Wells Fargo, despite signing on to a $25 billion settlement last year, big banks like Wells Fargo are still screwing over mortgage holders. A few weeks ago, a bank informed Orlando, Florida resident Etienne Sildor that it was beginning foreclosure proceedings. Here's the problem, though. Sildor has made his payments on time and sometimes even overpaid. That's right, he overpaid. And Wells Fargo is still trying to take away his home. A bank spokesperson says that Sildor, a father of three, violated some obscure technicality of his mortgage agreement. But let's be honest, the only criminal party here is Wells Fargo. And the very, very ugly Brian Fisher. During a Friday broadcast of his radio show, the American Family Association's Brian Fisher attacked the Boy Scouts of America for ending their ban on gay membership.
We might as well rename this organization now. BSA no longer stands for the Boy Scouts of America. It now stands for the Boy Sodomizers of America, because that is exactly what is going to happen. The infamous crime against nature now is going to be, it's been normalized, it's been endorsed, it's been embraced now by scouting leadership.
Lovely. So much for Christian understanding. Also, if you're, are you still comparing homosexuality to pedophilia, Brian? That's just very, very ugly. That's mind-boggling. Jason in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Jason.
Well, hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. You want to talk about our trade policies?
Yeah, I want to talk about our trade policies. I had a little short story to tell you. Actually, I'll keep it short for your program. But I was doing laundry the other day, and I washed up a bunch of clothes, and in those clothes was my favorite pair of jeans. It's a solid black pair of jeans that I wear for good things, like going out on a date with my wife. But anyway, I got to thinking about it, and I pulled them back out of the closet after I folded them up, and I was thinking back to how long ago I bought them. And I don't really want to play gotcha with you, but do you want to take a guess at how long ago it was?
You can just tell me.
All right, well, go ahead. I bought them when I was a sophomore in high school.
I'm guessing that's been some years.
20 years ago.
Wow.
So I opened them up and I looked at the label in the back, and guess what they say?
Made in the USA.
made in the USA. Levi Strauss silver tab jeans, they've probably been washed between 200 and 500 times.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can still wear them out on a date with my wife, put on a good shirt, nice.
Well, it's a nice testimonial to your control of your waistline too, Jason. But let me throw a story back at you here. I'll swap you. The first real business that I ever started, I started in the back of a head shop across the street from Michigan State University on the corner of Abbott Road and Albert Street. And I rented a shelf in this head shop. I can't remember the name of the head shop. And I was an electrical engineering major, and I was a ham radio operator, and I was really good at electronics. And so I put up a sign. I called it the electronics joint. And my logo was a rolled up cigarette with antenna wires coming out of the end. And I said, you know, leave your stereo or your TV set here, and I'll pick it up at night and I'll fix it and I'll bring it back the next day. And, you know, you can pay the guy who runs the head shop. And I paid him 25% of whatever I charged. So that was my, you know, plus I think 10 or 15 bucks a month rent for the shelf. And he took the money, and I took, you know, and so I came in every night, I picked up things and I took them home and I fixed them and I brought them back the next day. And that was so successful, fixing people's stereos and TVs, that we moved from the back of the head shop into an actual office over at the corner of MAC and Albert Street. And we ended up hiring, we had 5 or 6 people working for us. We had 4 technicians, full-time technicians. I was running a real business, and it was my first real business. It was also the one and only business that I actually killed. RCA had come out, or not RCA, one of the test companies had come out with a new test jig, because they were just making the transition. The TV sets were making a transition from tubes to modular integrated circuits and transistors. And it was a test jig to fix these things, this new technology, because tubes always burned out. And so I bought this $3,000 piece of test equipment on time, you know, with a bank loan. And then none of these TVs ever came in because they weren't breaking anymore. And we just, you know, we couldn't afford the overhead of the equipment that I had bought. So I learned a great business lesson from that, and I lost a business. But the interesting thing is that at that point in time in America, we didn't replace things, we repaired them, because they were really well built. And, you know, if your TV broke, you'd get it fixed. If your stereo broke, you'd get it fixed, because it was made in America and it was well made and it was accessible. And now they're not even designed to be repaired. I don't know of anybody who does repair work. Do you, Jason?
No, absolutely not. Let me throw a little bit more back at you.
Okay.
And, you know, back in the day when I bought these, I lived up in North Carolina, and it was a textile community. There was textile mill after textile mill after textile mill. And, you know, I guess this was the early 90s when I bought them, and things were just starting to shut down and being shipped overseas. But the interesting thing about it was that every textile mill, well, not all of them were independently owned. Maybe one company would own 2 or 3, but you had another company over here within a stone's throw that owned 2 or 3, and they were all competing with each other.
Right.
And that's where all this quality came from, was true competition. I buy a pair of jeans now, and they fall apart in a year and a half.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had these suckers for 20 years, back in the day when, you know, there was actual true competition in the marketplace. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think Americans, you know, people say, well, Americans want cheap junk from Walmart, you know, made in China or some other country. And I think not. I think Americans would pay an extra 10 or 20% for something that's going to last 100% longer. And they would pay that 10 or 20% also if that meant that they now had good manufacturing jobs that are paying twice what Walmart pays. And so I'm with you. Jason, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. And speaking of Walmart, Victoria Jones mentioned this, but it just, you know, here's the whole story. This is from the Associated Press. Walmart stores will pay $81 million after pleading guilty to criminal charges. Now, that they dumped hazardous waste across California. This involved over 20 prosecutors, 32 environmental groups. It's a decade-long investigation into criminal activity. Criminal activity. Is anybody going to jail? Well, no, of course not. some corporate executive made the decision to do this, and they don't go to jail. Are you kidding? It's Walmart. They're not going to send their executives to jail. They'll just pay the fine. Amazing. Gary in New Leipzig, North Dakota. You wanted to talk about pigweed. I remember pigweed. It's also called lamb's quarter. It's in the spinach family, actually.
Well, I think it's Arantha or something. It's a gourmet food in some countries.
Yeah, you're thinking of amaranth.
The irony
is amaranth is related.
And plow and try to kill it like an invasive monster.
Yeah.
And it has 30% protein in order to put in a crop like wheat that is 14% protein.
Yeah, and amaranth you can actually bake with the seeds. You get these little tiny seeds off the flower cluster heads at the top of it, and you can. It takes a lot of work to haul them, but you can bake with it. But yeah, that's.
I buy them as screenings from the elevator, a waste product to feed my chickens, and all the farmers tell me, "God, your chickens are so healthy and fat, and they look so good."
Oh, you should be putting it in your salads.
I know.
Of course.
Well, thanks, Tom.
You know, of course. Yeah, thank you, Gary. I mean, if it's coming off a field, it might be covered with Roundup or something. I don't know. Maybe there's Roundup Ready pigweed now. The genes have jumped. But it's incredible. I mean, I can now, Louise and I, having taken this wild plant taxonomy course at Wayne State, we can walk through a field and find probably 10% of everything around us we know how to eat. And that's kind of cool. And it's also actually useful. I mean, we walk through fields, go through the forest, whatnot. And, look at a fiddlehead that's not, uncurled or here's, you can pull a certain kind of grass, you can pull them out and just eat the it's called cambium in a tree. I don't remember what it's called in a grass. It might be the same thing. But the first inch or so of that you can eat. And dandelions, you want to catch them young and green, and pigsweed, lamb's quarter, amaranth. It's incredible what's up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Mark my words, somebody is going to revive Ewell Gibbons books, and there's going to be this generation's Ewell Gibbons coming along soon. It's your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back, Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Sure. I was just going to chime in with the point that not everything that's made in the USA is more expensive than competing products we purchase from China. I frequent this mom and pop dollar store that's close to my house, and I've purchased dustpans that have been manufactured in the USA, cups, pretty much anything I can find, and they're not that much more expensive.
Yeah, you're
right. I know that I'm supporting one of the few businesses remaining, in this country that's actually manufacturing things, and it didn't have to be shipped halfway across the world in order for it to end up in my possession.
Yep. It's just the product may not be more expensive. It's just that its company, the CEO of its company won't be, or the owners of its company won't be billionaires. But I mean, if you look at the cost to make tennis shoes, and then you look at the tennis shoes manufacturers who are billionaires, it's that's where the money is going, or much of the money is going. So excellent point, Marty. Thank you for calling and making it. Vince in Traverse City, Michigan. Hey, Vince, you're an air traffic controller?
No, I'm a traffic controller.
Go ahead.
And you had the guest or the caller earlier, and he was talking about the magnetic problems.
Yeah.
And he was saying that the Earth was tipping over on its side.
Yeah, and that airports are rewriting their runway numbers, which is something I'd never heard of. And I'm a pilot.
Right. Well,
are they?
I was in controller school way back. What happens? If you've got the liquid center of the Earth, basically, this magma.
Right.
And you've got
that's the core.
Plates just shifting.
Right.
And that's causing the magnetic North Pole to just sort of drift around very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And every so often, they will check an FAA plane that's come in, and they're doing the precision instrument approach and checking it to make sure that everything is in line. And when they get on the runway, they'll look down, and they got another one to see how that runway heading, and you probably, you don't know this though, but runway 18 really means it has a heading of 180 degrees.
Right, 180 degrees.
And it's straight south.
Yeah.
And if they see that it's coming toward this approach, they're going to have to change the runway number. They'll do it over a slow period. But this happens over decades and even centuries, maybe. It's a very slow process.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with the Earth blowing on its side. It's been going on forever.
Okay. Good. Vince, thanks for the reassurance. I appreciate that. And thanks for the information. Cindy, watching Free Speech TV in Independence, Kentucky. Hey, Cindy, what's up?
Last week you talked about your feelings that there were, or your opinions, that there was going to be another meltdown.
Yes.
My words, not yours. And
I'll own those words.
Beg pardon?
I agree with those words.
Okay, and being a, you know, tell me more.
Okay, well, here's my takeaway, and I just finished writing a book about this, which will be out in November, titled The Crash of 2016. But here's, in essence, the storyline. From the Reagan era through the end of the Clinton era, there was this massive wave of deregulation, of basically undoing the New Deal, letting investment banks and commercial banks merge, doing away with rules, bringing into being things like derivatives that never used to exist. Our derivatives market, which is an unregulated market, a banking market, went from not even existing in 1998 to being over $600 trillion today, and the GDP of the entire planet's only $65 trillion. It was $900 trillion before the big crash in 2008, and this was one of the main things that took down the banks. So what has happened is we had a structural system that worked, that made for a stable marketplace. We had relatively high taxation before Reagan dropped the top tax rate below 50%. Whenever top tax rates are above 50%, you have a stable economy for long periods of time. We were above 50% from 1935 until 1985 or 86, and it was very, very stable. Reagan dropped that down to 28%. The next year, you saw the biggest stock market crash since 1929, and in, I think it was 86, maybe 87. So that stabilizes the market, those high taxes, because people don't gamble with money that they have to pay taxes on. They treat it very, very carefully, number one. Number two, we changed the structure of things so that people could easily gamble with that money. And that easy gambling makes for a very, very unstable economy. So we have not fixed the essentials. What President Obama and this Congress have done, and President Bush before him, is, Bush, the whole thing kind of fell apart on Bush's watch. And what Obama has done is kind of put it back together with baling wire and bubble gum and scotch tape. But it's really not together. It's really, they're reinflating the bubble. I mean, we're seeing it. We just saw a 10-point rise in housing prices year over year. That, to me, is an indication of a new bubble. And until we actually change the fundamentals, until we bring back Glass-Steagall, until we do away with, you know, literally undo Phil Gramm's Commodity Futures Modernization Act and make it illegal to trade commodities, derivatives, unless you're going to trade them in a licensed and transparent commodity marketplace, break up the big banks and go back to having banks that are, you know, reasonable and community-based, reinforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act like Reagan stopped doing in 1982, until we undo the damage that's been done by 32 years of Reaganomics and go back to fundamentals, we're continuously going to have an economy that's like just trembling, just waiting for the big wind to blow it over. And my guess is that the big wind is either going to be an international incident or it's going to be the student loan bubble bursting. But my guess is that the Obama administration is going to do everything they can to keep this thing going until November of 2016, the next presidential election, so they don't hurt the next Democratic candidate. The same way Bush tried to keep it going until November of 2008, and Bush mistimed it by about 6 months. And we'll see if Obama can pull it off or not. But that's my prediction. I could be very wrong. I sure hope I am. But check in with me, Cindy, in 2016, and we'll compare notes. Thank you for the call. Coming up tomorrow, the IRS and the Tea Party, ISA and Graham. By the way, the good news about what I just described is that it will produce change, and I think it'll produce, as Robbie Batra calls it, a new golden age. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.